Soren Kierkegaard, who knew a lot about how the Christian life works and how easily it is that the culture and society at large and the people in the neighborhood distract and sometimes make it difficult for us to hear and respond to the voice of God, frequently insisted that the more people, the less truth. A large crowd does not provide favorable conditions for hearing the voice of God. We've got a large crowd. So during these days together, I'm going to ignore the crowd and speak to five men and women Jesus once described as the little flock. You don't know who you are, and I don't know who you are, but I know that there's a lot of just crowd that we're in that distracts us from what God is doing. And who knows what the Spirit might do with just five people. Maybe multiply them just as Jesus did with those five loaves of bread for 5,000 picnickers on that hillside in Galilee. If he can do it in Galilee, he can do it in Mount Hermon. I have a text for the next three addresses I will be giving you. It's a single sentence placed strategically at almost the exact center of John's gospel. Jesus is speaking using the metaphor of shepherd to describe himself and of sheep to refer to us, calling himself the good shepherd and designating us as the sheep. In that context, he says, "I came that they may have life and have it abundantly," abundantly, generously, lavishly, gloriously. I want us together to make a determined effort to interpret the lives we have been given by Jesus through this frame of abundance, generosity. Remember the sign that Jesus performed at Cana, turning water into wine at the wedding? We just sang about that. And not just enough to get by with when the wine ran out, but six stone jars, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Each jar filled up to the brim. That's abundant. That's generous. That's the Jesus signature on the life that he gives us. This is the first sign that Jesus provides to signal the mode in which he works. He did not come to save us from a bad life and then send us off to see what we could do with it. His design is that we live extravagantly. All through his life on this earth, and as he continues to be with us in the Holy Spirit, he is expanding our imaginations, which is to say, our faith, to embrace a life of fullness, a life of joy, an artesian spring of love, a generous life. The middle initial of my name is H. My wife thinks it stands for hyperbole. It does not. All my hyperboles, I tell her, are understatements. Those six stone jars are implicit in every page of John's gospel, implicit in everything Jesus says, and implicit in everything Jesus does, full up to the brim in all the ways which we encounter and respond to Jesus in our lives. What I propose in these next three addresses to you is to do my best to immerse you in this sense of abundance, not just in general, but in the actual conditions in which we serve a generous God and live a generous life. The conditions are made up of this place in which we live, this creation, this salvation story in which we're involved, and this community and the church, the people of God with whom we worship and serve. A generous creation, a generous salvation, a generous church. And just so we don't lose our way in all the trees of creation and the events of salvation and the forest of generosity. I'm going to orient what we are doing around three vantage points in the revelation of Jesus: Jesus' birth, Jesus' death, and Jesus' resurrection. Jesus is the incarnation of the Godhead, the embodiment of what no one has ever seen. Everything that makes up this abundant life, this generous life, is revealed and encountered in Jesus. We don't make this up. We don't have to guess and speculate. It's all here, first revealed in the birth, death, and resurrection of Jesus, and continuously made present to us day by day by day in the Spirit of Jesus. Remember that Jesus himself told us this: the Father will give you another counselor to be with you forever. I will not leave you desolate. I will come to you. These things I have spoken to you, that my joy might be in you and that your joy may be full. This is the Jesus generosity. And this is what I want to insist on, that there are no generalities, no principles, no abstractions. This is all local and particular and personal. And pastors are the servants of the church to insist on this always. Local, particular, personal. It is all revealed in the flesh and blood of Jesus, his birth, death, and resurrection. And it is all lived in our actual flesh and blood, our birth, our death, our resurrection, in the actual place where we have families, work for a living, vote in our elections, make decisions about our economics, among the actual people with whom we worship. Generosity is not an abstraction, not a cliche, not an idea, not a dream. This is all lived stuff. I hope you don't misunderstand me, but I have virtually no interest in whether the Bible and the life to which it is witness is true or not. I assume it is true. I've always assumed that it's true. But what I'm interested in is insisting on the fact that it is livable. This isn't something to argue about or fight over. This is to be lived, and if it's not lived, forget it. And to make sure that livability is alive in our awareness, I want to anchor everything that we deal with in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. Today, the anchor is the birth of Jesus, following the first reference to Jesus' birth in our New Testament by Paul. Jesus is the firstborn of creation. Later this morning, our salvation will be anchored in the death of Jesus. I have been crucified with Christ, and tomorrow we'll anchor it in our holy community, our church in the resurrection of Jesus, Christ in you, the hope of glory. So, are you ready? The birth of Jesus in this creation, this place we live, our neighborhood. We wake up in the morning, you did this morning, to a world we did not make. How did it get here? How did we get here? We open our eyes and see that old bowling ball, the sun, careen over the horizon. We wiggle our toes. A mockingbird takes off and improvises on themes set down by robins, vireos, and wrens. We marvel at the intricacies. The smell of frying bacon worked its way into our nostrils. I didn't know that it was going to be there this morning, but it was. And we began anticipating buttered toast, scrambled eggs, we really did, and coffee freshly brewed from our favorite Javanese beans. There's so much here. Around, above, below, inside, outside, even with the help of poets and scientists, we can account for very little of it. We notice this, then that. We start exploring the neighborhood. We try this street and then that one. We venture across the tracks. Before long, we're looking out through telescopes and down into microscopes, curious, fascinated by this endless proliferation of sheer isness, color and shape and texture and sound. After a while, we get used to it and quit noticing. We get narrowed down into something small and constricting. Somewhere along the way, this exponential expansion of awareness, this wide-eyed looking around, this sheer untaught delight of what is here, reverses itself. The world contracts. We're reduced to a life of routine through which we sleepwalk. But not for long. Something always shows up to jar us awake. A child's question, a fox's sleek beauty, a sharp pain, a pastor's sermon, a fresh metaphor, an artist's vision, a slap in the face, scent from a crushed violet. We're again awake, alert, and wonder, how did this happen? How does this happen? And why this? Why anything at all? Why not nothing at all? Well, gratitude is a spontaneous response to all of this, to life. Something swells up within us, thank you. More often than not, the thank you is directed to God, even by those who don't believe in him. Johnny Bergman was a young man in my congregation. He and his wife were enthusiastic participants, but then the weeds of a distracting world choked their young faith. They acquired children. They became suddenly wealthy, and their lives filled up with boats and cars, house building, social engagements. They were less and less frequently in church. After 2 years of absence, on a bright, sunshiny Sunday, Johnny was there again. Surprised to see him, I said, Johnny, what brought you here? He said, I woke up this morning feeling so good, so blessed, so created. That was his word. I just had to say thank you. And this is the only place I could think of to say it rightly, adequately. I wanted to say it to Jesus. The next Sunday, his string of absences resumed. But all the same, the moment strikes me as epiphanic and so very, very accurate. The sheer wonder of life, of creation, of this place where we find ourselves at this moment requires response. Thank you. There's something so deeply congruent with the world we live in and who we are that when we become aware of it, we exclaim at the miracle and wonder of it. Several years later, after a divorce and a death, Johnny was back in the congregation. This time he stayed. He's still there, worshiping in that congregation in Maryland. In the ancient world, Plato observed that all philosophy begins in wonder. A modern philosopher used the phrase radical astonishment to say the same thing. Wonder, astonishment, adoration. There can't be many of us for whom the sheer fact of existence hasn't rocked us back upon our heels. We take off our sandals before the burning bush. We catch our breath at the sight of a plummeting hawk. Thank you, God. We find ourselves in a lavish existence in which we feel a deep sense of kinship. We belong here. We say thanks with our lives to God. And not just thanks or thank it, but thank you. Now, most of the people who have lived on this planet Earth have identified this you with God or gods. This is not just a matter of learning our manners, the way children learn to say thank you as a social grace. Rather, it's a cultivation of adequateness within ourselves to the nature of reality, developing the capacity to sustain an adequate response to the overwhelming giftedness and goodness of life. Wonder is the only adequate launching pad for exploring the reality of creation, keeping us open-eyed, expectant, alive to life that is always more than we can account for, that always exceeds our calculations, that is always beyond anything we can make. Naturally, we're interested in what is behind all this, the purpose, the implications, and we begin by believing in God. Creation is not something we figure out. Creation is not something we deduce or argue or simply appreciate as is. It's what we believe. Credo. By faith, we understand that the world is created by the Word of God, so that all that is seen was made out of things which do not appear. The Colossians passage states that quite succinctly this morning. By creation as such, we are not compelled to believe in God. There are plenty of people who take creation on its own terms, often designated simply as nature, and approach it as if meaning its spirituality were inherent in it. There's something very attractive about this. It's so clean and uncomplicated and non-controversial and obvious. We get a satisfying sense of the inherently divine in life itself without all the complications of theology, the mess of church history, the hypocrisies of men and women who insist on taking up space in church pews. Don't laugh. What comes next is the incompetence of pastors. Creation on its own seems perfectly capable of furnishing us with a spirituality that exalts in beautiful beaches, fine sunsets, surfing and skiing and body massage, emotional states and aesthetic titillation. But for all of its considerable attraction, it is considerably deficient in person. Our Christian scriptures take quite a different tack. God reveals himself most completely in a named person, Jesus. The Genesis stories of creation begin with heaven and earth, but that turns out to be merely a warm-up for the main event, the creation of human life, man and woman designated image of God. Man and woman are alive with the very breath, spirit, of God. If you went to look at creation, full creation at its highest, you look at a person, a man, a woman, a child. And if you stick around long enough, Jesus. The faddish preference for appreciating creation in a bouquet of flowers, but turning your back on a squalling baby, or for a day on the beach rather than rubbing shoulders with uncongenial neighbors in a cold church. Creation with inconvenience of persons excised is understandable, but it's decidedly not creation in the terms it has been revealed to us. So all this comes together as good news. Creation is God's gift of life and the conditions for our life, our lives, in the birth of Jesus. The birth of Jesus provides the focus for receiving, entering into, and participating in creation, for living the creation and not just using it or taking it for granted. In the act of believing in creation, we accept and enter and submit to what God does, what God does and makes. We are not spectators of creation, but participants in it. We are participants, first of all, by simply being born. But then we realize that our births all take place in the defining context of Jesus' birth. The Christian life is the practice of living in what God has done and is doing. We want to know the origins of things, not to satisfy our curiosity about fossils and dinosaurs and the Big Bang, but so that we can live out of our origins. We don't want our lives to be tacked onto something peripheral. We want to live originally, not derivatively. So we begin with Jesus. Jesus is the revelation of the God who created heaven and earth. He is also the revelation of the God who is with us. I love Barth's sentence, from every angle, Jesus Christ is the key to the secret of creation. God is the creator, and his most encompassing creation is human life, a baby. As participants in creation, we do it too. When we beget and conceive, give birth to and raise babies, we are in on the heart of creation. every birth is a proclamation of the gospel. I had a good friend whose brother was an atheist, a smart atheist, one of the most wonderful kind or worst kind, I don't know which. And he was so vociferous in his atheism, and then he got married and had a baby. And my friend said, I think he's close to the kingdom. I think he was. There's more gospel in all those biblical begats. And Ezekiah begat Manasseh, and Manasseh begat Amon, and Amon begat Josiah, than we ever dreamed. Birth, any birth, is our access to the creation work of God. Jesus' virgin birth provides and maintains the focus that God himself is personally present and totally participant in creation. It's good news indeed. The birth of Jesus, kept fresh in our imaginations and prayers, in song and story, keeps our feet on solid ground, creation ground, and responsive to every nuance of obedience and praise evoked by the life all around us. But this has never been an easy truth for people to swallow. There are always plenty of people around who will have none of this particularity, this human ordinariness. Birth is painful, babies are inconvenient and messy, there's an enormous trouble involved in having children. Didn't God know that? God as a baby? It is far easier to accept God as the creator of the majestic mountains, the rolling sea, the delicate wildflowers, fanciful unicorns, and tigers burning bright. When it comes to the sordid squalor of the raw material involved in being human, God is surely going to keep his distance from that. We have deep aspirations native to our souls that abhor this business of diapers and debts, government taxes and domestic trivia. We imagine that we were created for higher things, but there is a world of subtle ideas and of fine feelings and exquisite ecstasies for us to cultivate. We want to be spiritual without having to put up with the body, with stuff, with things, with people we don't like. In the name of God, we avoid the creation of God, preferring feelings and ideas, an idealized Jesus. The feature attraction of this kind of thing is that we no longer have to take seriously, that is, with eternal seriousness, with God's seriousness, either things or people. This way of thinking and living, in effect, denies the gospel embedded in creation, the body of Jesus, and in our bodies. And we have no language or imagination to recognize and participate in this generosity of God that is revealed in the body of Jesus and our bodies. This way of thinking and living is a virus in the bloodstream of religion. It resurfaces every generation or so, advertised as brand new, replete with a new brand and name. It is spirituality without the inconvenience of creation, without the inconvenience of sin or morality, without the inconvenience of people we don't like, who aren't our kind. Maybe what is most attractive of all, it offers us a spirituality without God, at least any God other than the spark of divinity I sense within me. For a long time, my interest in creation was restricted to arguing with my schoolmates. I loved picking fights with my atheist and evolutionist friends about Genesis 1 and 2. When I became a pastor, I began to realize how powerful the Genesis creation is for dealing with life just as it comes to us each day. My shift from reading Genesis 1, 2 primarily as an account of the beginning of all things, which of course it is, to reading it as a text for beginning to live right now took place early in my life as a pastor. As I was learning how to lead my congregation into an obedient life of worshiping God and following Jesus, I was struck by how extensively the cultural and spiritual conditions in which I was working in suburban Maryland matched the exile conditions of the Hebrews in the 6th century before Christ. A pervasive uprootedness and loss of place, a loss of connection with their traditions of worship, a sense of being immersed in a foreign and idolatrous society, a feeling that the workplace was totally secular, separated from the life of faith. I felt that I and my congregation were starting over every week. There was no moral consensus, no common memory, all of us far removed from who we had grown up. The lives of my parishioners seemed jerky and spasmodic, anxious and hurried, with little sense of place or grounding. When I realized that these were the identical exile conditions lived through by the people of God in the 6th century BC, I started preaching and teaching these Isaianic exile texts that came from the lips and pen of the pastor Isaiah to the Hebrew exiles in Babylon. Those great pastoral messages to people who had lost touch with their time and place in the world. And in doing that, I discovered something I'd never noticed before, that one of the most important Isaianic words used with these exiled people was create. Create is a word that is used in the Bible exclusively with God as the subject. Men and women don't create, can't, but God does. When nothing we can do makes any difference and we're left standing around empty-handed and clueless, we're ready for God to create. When the conditions in which we live seem totally alien to life and salvation, we are reduced to waiting for God to do what only God can do, create. The words create and creator occur more times in the exile preaching of Isaiah than any other place in the Bible. 16 times as compared with the 6 occurrences in the great creation narratives of Genesis 1 and 2. Well, as I pursued this pastoral task, I realized how immediate and powerful, how convincing and life-changing the creation work of God is among people who feel so uncreated and so unformed and unfitted for the world in which they find themselves. While under Isaiah's influence, I was moving from my pulpit to hospital rooms, family rooms, coffee shops, community gatherings, praying with and listening to bored or devastated men and women, create emerged out of the background of what happened long ago in Canaan and Babylon and Egypt into prominence in my community as an actively gospel word of what God is doing today among the exiled people with whom I was living. After several years of this, I came back to Genesis in a fresh way and found in these texts urgency and freshness and immediacy that surprised me. No longer was I reading Genesis and asking, what does this mean? How can I use this? I was asking, how can I obey this? How can I get in on this? The Bible, Genesis, and Jesus provides grounding texts for forming and leading us into a living abundantly to the glory of God in the generous gift of creation. Sister Lycan was a significant person for helping me to become a participant in the lived quality of creation, the land of the living, and not just a spectator to it. I grew up in a spiritual culture that was dismissive, if not outright contemptuous, of time and place. Time was just putting in time, until the final intervention of God that would put an end to time and usher in eternity. Meanwhile, there was a lot to do. Witness to our friends, send out missionaries, hold street meetings, go to the jail every Sunday afternoon and sing and preach to the prisoners. But nothing held our attention for very long. We had to make sure we were ready and then hurry to get everybody we knew ready for the end, the rapture, the second coming of Jesus. We had no time for anything but the briefest of vacations, no time to go to college, no time for games, no time for creation. Time was just about up. Time was not honored for its own sake. Its only value was to get us ready for the end time. end time was the only sacred time. Everything else, days and weeks, minutes and hours, was to be used in service to the end time. If you're not using it for some sanctified project of some spirit-anointed goal, you were wasting time. Sister Lycan, every adult in our small congregation was either a sister or brother, was a significant figure in this world. She was an ancient, small wisp of a woman, 5 feet tall and shrinking. She lived in a small house in our neighborhood. The shades were always drawn. I walked or rode my bike past her house often. I never saw her step out of her always darkened house except on Sunday each week when we picked her up and drove her to church. During the testimony and prayer time, with liturgical regularity in our defiantly anti-liturgical Pentecostal worship, she stood to her feet and said that our Lord had revealed to her that she would not die before his second coming in glory. He told her that she would be caught up with all the saints in the clouds and meet him in the air every Sunday, word perfect. I was very impressed. When I was about 8 years old, I started calculating how much time I had on earth. For I took it for granted that I also would be caught up. She was at least 90 years old. Giving her increasing feebleness and loss of stature, she was shrinking at the rate of about an inch a year. I figured she might live and therefore the rapture be held off for another 5 or 6 years. I would be 14 when the rapture occurred. That meant that I'd never get to drive a car. It was a big disappointment. When I was 10 years old, Sister Lycan died. I can still remember my confusion during the funeral service. I kept waiting for Pastor Herman to say something about the second coming, but he didn't. Silence. The next Sunday, one of the pillars of my childhood experience of worship was gone. The building was still standing. The accustomed congregation was still there, intact, no rapture, and no one even seemed to notice. 10 years is not a propitious age to figure out matters eschatological, so I eventually dropped it. 2 or 3 years later, I was plunged into adolescence, the age in which biology virtually obliterates eschatology. Now everything was present, immediate, firsthand, no connections with either past or future. Pastor and future alike took on shadowy existence. But eventually I found myself dealing with it again. As I worked myself into adulthood, I was reading my Bible with more diligence, paying attention to how this gospel of Jesus got lived, not just talked about, not just given witness to, not just studied and memorized. And I gradually realized that ordinary time is not what biblical people endure or put up with or hurry through as we wait around for the end time and the rocket launch into eternity. It's a gift through which we participate in the present and daily work of God. I finally got it. End time influences present, ordinary time, not by diminishing it or denigrating it, but by sharing it, filling it with purpose and significance. The end time is not a future we wait for, but the gift of the fullness of time that we receive in adoration and obedience as it flows into the present. But I was not done with Sister Lycan. When I became a pastor and was learning to deal with my congregation, under the influence of Isaiah's take on creation, we begin to immerse ourselves in creation now. I fantasized a scenario in which I was again 10 years old. It is a month or so before Sister Lycan dies. Remember, this is a scenario. This is in my head. I go to her house and knock on her door. She opens and invites me in. I am no stranger there, for my mother occasionally sent me over with a plate of cookies. The usual routine was that after she let me in, she would go to the kitchen and bring me a glass of milk. We would sit there in our knick-knack crowded living room with the shades pulled. I would eat my cookie and drink my milk in the darkened, sunless room. But this day, in my fantasized scenario, while she was in the kitchen getting the milk, I let up the blinds from all the windows, and as she returns with the milk, I exclaim, "Sister Lycan, look, the world." Startled, she drops the milk and shatters the glass. In her confusion, I take her hand and lead her across the street and down a trail to a swampy pond, Lawrence Slough, where I and my friends loved to go. I showed her the turtles and the frogs. She had never seen either. I showed her a nesting osprey waiting for the next fish, the downy heads of its chick just visible on the nest. She's amazed. Just then a white-tailed deer leaps from a tangle of cattails. She asks what it is. I tell her it's one of Solomon's gazelles. She's astonished. I'm afraid she's getting too excited. So I lead her back home and help her clean up the spilled milk and broken glass. The next Sunday in worship, she stands to her feet at the usual time, but she doesn't say the usual words. This time she says, "An angel visited me this week and showed me wonders I'd never seen. He said he'd come back on Thursday and show me more. I'm not sure I want to leave and be with the Lord yet." Each succeeding Thursday, I go to her house, take her by the hand, lead her down the path to the pond, and show her more wonders. One day, we stay late in the evening and watch the setting sun throw a kaleidoscope of color over the surface of the water. She is in awe. One afternoon, we watch a kingfisher catch minnows and fly off singing his triumphant, scratchy imitation of a rusty gate. She is enthralled. Another day, I bring sandwiches, half a loaf of stale Wonder Bread. We sit in a log on the edge of the water, eat our lunch, and feed two swans and seven or eight mergansers who are showing off their dashing, swept-back hairdos. She loves it. As we walk home, holding hands, she says, "And to think all this has been going on practically in my backyard." Each Thursday, she remembers psalms and scriptures from Sunday worship and connects them with what she is feeling and seeing as we meander in Lawrence Slough. Sunday is no longer the anticipation of a final escape. It's an exposition of the week, or at least the Thursday segment of it. She never gives me credit as the angel. And each week, the congregation remarks on the lessening enthusiasm of Sister Lycan for being raptured from behind her drawn shades. The concluding sentence of her weekly report in the testimony time takes on a creation rhythm. "I'm not sure I want to leave quite yet." And after 4 weeks of this, Sister Lycan dies. Well, this is all fantasy, of course, casting my 10-year-old self in the role of ministering angel. But my fantasy has a factual base in those childhood years of listening to Sister Lycan's creation of literary liturgy each Sunday. And for me now, the fantasy has turned into a way of life, the lived quality of a generous creation that fuels my efforts in trying to raise the blinds in the living quarters of so many people I know and have known, to raise the blinds and get them out of the house and enter this vast creation extravaganza, seeing and hearing, tasting and touching and smelling what Jesus, from before the foundation of the world, has been creating by his word. Sky and earth, plants and trees, stars and planets, fish and birds, Jersey cows and basset hounds, and the crowning touch, man and woman. Look at them, wonder of wonders, male and female, and all of this anchored in Jesus, the firstborn of all creation. What I'm attempting right now is a total immersion, a baptism in this creation that provides us the time and place to receive and then participate in this abundant life that Jesus told us that he has come to bring us into. I want to cultivate an imagination adequate for recognizing this generous creation that pivots on Jesus' birth. I'm interested in experiencing creation as a generous act of God revealed in Jesus as an act of generosity, the gift of abundant life. Amen.
We have about 15 minutes, and Eugene's agreed to answer some questions. Please, any questions you might have related to what he's talked about, any left-turn tangents, he has a Q&A on tomorrow afternoon that you can go there with him. But generous creation, anything that you'd like to ask him this morning, we have mics going around both sides. So please ask your question in the mic. We'll look for hands. Thanks.
Dr. Peterson, can you talk about the wonders of creation and God's creation that he gave us, and yet jump forward to John's gospel where he talks about Jesus coming into a dark world, a world that doesn't accept him, and that we sometimes talk about that as being the created world, as being that sinful world that doesn't accept Christ?
Well, that's John's terminology. World for him becomes a way to designate the unbelieving world. I think you have to pay attention to his vocabulary in the context in which he writes. But, you know, every one of these unbelievers or miscreants or whatever they are is part of this good creation. And whether they know it or not, care about it or not, they are our brothers and sisters created by Christ. I read a book recently given to me by a friend. It's called Patience with God. And it's written by a man named Halleck, H-A-L-I-K. I can't remember his first name. He's a Czech. He was under the communist rule during the Russian occupation. And he was a psychiatrist. This was a time when all religion was banished. Anything Christian was hidden. And he became, during that time, a Christian. And he had to do it secretly underground. He lived with his mother, and his mother never knew it. He became a priest. And when the Velvet Revolution took place, and there was now freedom, Vaclav Havel was a poet, playwright, who had been in prison quite a bit through those communist years, and he immediately became president. The whole country acclaimed him as president, and he chose Halleck to be his chief advisor. I don't think Havel was a confessed Christian, but he believed everything we do, as far as I can tell. He was very influential to me. I was an early pastor. And so Halleck was in a position to look back over those years and recognize things, and he wrote this book, Patience with God. And he takes as his metaphor Zacchaeus in the tree, watching Jesus, hoping to be out of sight, unobtrusive, and Jesus sees him and invites himself to dinner. Halleck uses Zacchaeus as a kind of metaphor for what he calls all the atheists and secularists in our society. He says these people are brilliant, many of them, and they're searching for something, and they're curious, and we treat them like the enemy. Don't do that. He says this is our great mission field, but we've got to listen to these people. We've got to get them out of the tree and have dinner with them. And he says, God is being patient with them. You be patient with them. He says he was patient with me. I think we've got to revise our imagination in terms of who we think the enemy is. We don't have enemies. We have people who are looking for God, maybe in the wrong ways, but that's who we're witnesses. That's what we're here for to be witness to them, not their enemies. That's all. That was a long answer, but...
I heard and appreciated your point that obviously God is the creator, but I wonder if there's a link for us to live into that creation, for us to be creative, for human beings to be creative. What's the nature of that link, given what you said already today?
The nature of the link, I think artists are, and every parent knows that when your children are young, they're artists. They're making things, they're discovering things. Now, most of us get the artistry read out of us by our school system, but there are a lot of them who make it. And I think we encourage artists, we listen to artists. I think, as a pastor, I think the artist is one of my chief allies, opening my eyes, my ears, to music, to the world. Scientists who don't believe in God sometimes make me believe in God all the more. Thank you, scientists, atheists. I think the way Jesus lived, and the way, you know, we see so many people living generously, opening their lives, awaiting patience with God. He says, we're too impatient. We want quick results. I mean, this is what Halleck says. But, you know, your own kids teach you a lot about artists. And all of us are probably, at some level, deep down, artists. We've got to make a living. And that's tough. For artists.
You mentioned that man and woman are the crown of God's creation. How best do you recommend that we listen to the culture that seems to be saying the importance of same-sex marriage?
I must confess I'm kind of an agnostic on that. I don't know what's going on. I don't understand same-sex attraction. Just escapes me totally. But, you know, I know and you know devout Christians who are attracted same-sex. I've been pastor to them. You've been pastor to them. I have a hard time thinking they're evil people. They pray, they believe, they follow, they live good lives. I think the jury's not out on that. And I'm not going to be in a hurry. I'm not an evangelist for that way of life, but I want to be, maybe these people are sitting up in the sycamore tree. I don't know. I guess the one thing I do know, and just in terms of my own, well, I'm an old man, and I say I'm an old man, but quoting Wendell Berry, I don't feel like an old man. I feel like a young man with unseen debilities. So I don't have a congregation, at least not a visible one on Sunday mornings. But I'd rather be with the people who are patient and waiting. And the one thing that kind of sticks with me is when I was ordained 54 years ago, I was a new Presbyterian. I grew up in a Pentecostal church where you pretty much did what you wanted to do. If you didn't like the church, you started another one. And entering the Presbyterian church was just kind of a freedom for me. And I remember the vows I took. They've changed through the years, but as in my memory was, I was promising to be subject to my brethren. If my brethren say it, if I like it or not, it doesn't make any difference. I made that vow. It's as sacred as a marriage vow, as far as I'm concerned. So that's kind of what that's my personal stance and the way I live my life now. I know that doesn't answer your questions. There's a lot. It's very, for those of you who are involved in difficult situations, it's the only thing I can hope for is that there's patience involved in waiting for some of those people to come down out of the tree and join what God is doing.
Okay. I really appreciate so much what you've been talking about in terms of, you know, connecting ourselves to this world. And, you know, your experience growing up in Pentecostalism, kind of the way I see Pentecostalism is sort of a correction to too much rational, which is its own way of separating itself from creation, you know. And so we have this great understanding that, you know, spirituality really is about the dirt, you know, the real stuff of this world. You got to get out there and experience it. But on the other hand, we also have this idea that spirituality is also from another world. There's this otherworldness to it. There is a transfiguration. There is these dramatic healings that go on. So how do you sort of interweave these two ideas together and bring them into unity?
You want the next lecture? I'm not trying to oversimplify anything. You know, I loved growing up Pentecostal, to tell you the truth. I mean, everything was alive. And I got the feeling that, you know, all my evangelical friends were trying to prove the accuracy of the Bible. I was committed to living it. And I just seemed to me there was just a chasm. I mean, they were so mean-spirited. I mean, just they would crush anybody who disagreed with them. So a friend of mine, Tim Stafford, just is recently written, finished. The book will be published in, I don't know, 3 or 4 months. And it's called Miracles. Now, Tim, for those of you who know him, is a journalist, Presbyterian journalist, actually, he and his wife. And he travels the world. He writes for CT frequently. He's a prolific writer. And he loves traveling, India, Africa, South America, and he's immersed in this whole cross, this wonderful range of spirituality, charismatic spirituality, missionary, and he wants to honor every, I mean, he does what a journalist does, so good journalists do so well. He reports what's there without judging it. And of course, what's there in Africa, India, is a lot of miracles that we've never seen, and he's never seen. But he says, I respect the people who report them, and I listen to them, and I pay attention. I realize God has a lot more ways of working than I grew up with in North America. There's a kind of a simplicity and honesty and childlikeness. But he doesn't try to prove anything. He's trying to accept and enter into what's there. And he does that honestly, tenaciously, actually. He's, you know, traveling in India and Africa, South America, some of these places. It's hard. So what I've tried to cultivate is a natural, supernatural imagination. A lot of what I see, I didn't recognize as a miracle in the first place. And then I did. And my exposure to miracles is, it's not totally absent, but sometimes it takes me a while to notice what happened. And it's people I've just totally given up on, I think they're just nuts. Suddenly they're dear friends in Christ, praying together. How did that happen? It wasn't by anything I did. I didn't like them. And so I just think if we know too much, we miss too much. And I'd like to cultivate a supernatural imagination, ready for anything God does. And responsive to it, whether I can explain it or not. Mostly I can't explain it. And I find that convenient. Well, I felt making that decision long time, many years ago, in my early years as a pastor, has given me a pastoral imagination which is able to deal with a lot of things that otherwise wouldn't. I couldn't. That's all.